Hey, welcome back to Good Growing with a Garden Gal. I'm George Corliss.
And I'm Jelaine Fetter.
And I'm Teresa Williams.
And she's the Garden Gal. And this segment, we're going to be talking about where does the water go? And we've been talking off air about where do the stones and rocks come from? And then we're kind of talking about different friends that have come up with different ideas. And so I'm throwing this out there to you folks. If you know where the rocks and stones come from every spring when you're going out there and rototilling or getting your garden ready to plant, why do those great big rocks all of a sudden come out of nowhere? They weren't there last year or the year before.
The thing is, like, being, you know, married to the farmer, every year they're out there picking up the, you know, rocks and the big stones out of the field every year. Get rid of them. Where do they come next year? They're growing. Rocks don't grow, but they sure show up in your fields.
Rock gardens.
Yes, I know. But so, yeah, we're going to discuss it. We're going to find out some things.
Yeah, one of these days. So if you've got any answers, give us a call. That's at 231-468-2087. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that subject. And Garden Gal, have you got any thoughts or ideas on that one?
I'm going to ask my favorite geologist.
Oh, you are? Oh, that's right. Your son.
Yes.
Yeah, your son. And so, and you were saying, we have a friend by the name of Pam, and she said?
Right, and she lives in Leroy, and they have a farm. And, a couple of things. One thing, the devil's always bringing rocks, you know. But because the earth rotates, you know, I don't know what the speed is that somebody knows that, it's out there. But because it's rotating, the centrifugal force could be forcing rocks that are in the middle of the earth up to the top. And that kind of does make sense. So you find out.
I think freezing and thawing cycles have something to do with it. But I'll ask my favorite geologist what his take is on that.
Yeah.
All right. Runoff from rain or irrigation can cause soil erosion. And this early summer, especially in a lot of the central counties here in northern Michigan, wow, that was just unbelievable. I mean, they got 7-8 inches of rain in just a very short period of time in less than a day, and then got rained on after that. So, Teresa, where does the water go?
Well, we hope it goes into the soil. That's the goal. And if you've got a healthy soil that has good pore space, you're going to maximize the amount of water that goes into your soil. If that's not the case, and sometimes we just get really excessive rains. If you get a 4-inch rain, that's challenging.
Especially in a short time.
Yeah. So what we want to do is try and get that water safely to a creek or to a river. And safe ways of getting water, after you've done your best to keep the water going downward and not outward, things like buffer strips, grass waterways, filter strips, those can all help slow down that water and help the water drop any loads of sediment or nutrients or pesticides that might be in it, so that when it reaches our rivers or our streams, it's clean. And so we can keep, you know, have the best of both worlds, have our crops growing and have clean water.
Now, sandy soil absorbs water much better.
Yes.
But then when you have that heavy or clay soil, that's you drive and you see these fields that are just standing water because it rains so much and it hasn't absorbed yet.
Yeah, I worked for the Soil Conservation Service for many years, and we have different equations that we run to try and figure out how much erosion is likely to happen on a particular field. And on our sandy fields, they're much more prone to wind erosion, not so much water erosion. Our heavier soils, our clays, our loams, just the opposite. They're not very prone to wind erosion, but they're very susceptible to water erosion. So we want to keep those soils covered with something. Maybe crop residue through conservation tillage, maybe cover crops like we mentioned in the earlier segment. So the goal is to not have bare soil if you can help it, because bare soil is very vulnerable to erosion.
Now, what about the fertilizers and the pesticides and all these other things that specifically farmers use, but even backyard gardeners use them a lot of times? A lot of rain, that ends up in the runoff. And if it runs off into our streams and our lakes, what kind of damage is that causing?
Well, if any of your listeners live near Lake Erie, last summer, and summer before, there were some significant problems with water quality in Western Lake Erie. The city of Toledo gets its drinking water from Western Lake Erie, and there was a huge algae bloom that put all of those folks who depend on that water in a very difficult situation. How are they going to get clean drinking water for themselves? So that's one of the reasons why is, you know, we drink water. We need to make sure it's clean. And we have, in Michigan at least, we have a different categories of use that we evaluate. Okay, is this water good for fishing? Is it good for swimming? Is it good for drinking? And we want to prevent impairment of those uses of our water.
I know I live, have a house around Lake Mitchell, and they're wanting people that might have sump pumps. Most people have don't have basements, they might have crawl space, but they used to just pump the water right from the sump pumps into the lake. You can't do that anymore. They want it to be pumped out into your yard, and then as it travels, you know, especially like in my yard, I've got it slopes down to the lake. Mm-hmm. Well, that's okay that the water comes out of the sump pump, you know, the crawl space, as long as it goes through the grass and works its way, because that way, then, like you're saying, any sediments or something, you know, would be settled into
the
ground.
They're filtered out by the grass.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in a lot of places now, you can't buy lawn fertilizer with phosphorus in it unless you have a soil test showing that your soils are deficient in phosphorus, because that phosphorus moves with soil particles. It's what we call adsorbed. It is AD as in David rather than absorbed. Adsorbed. It stays on the outside of those soil particles. And so when those soil particles move, if there's phosphorus attached to those soil particles, the phosphorus moves with it, and that causes a lot of those algae blooms.
And those algae blooms, I was trying to think here in Cadillac, hasn't Lake Mitchell gotten a number of those here in the last couple of years?
I think both Lake Cadillac and Mitchell have had issues, and, you know, and because that's, yeah, they don't like the people that, you know, have lawn care, and they don't want all that stuff running into the lake.
Because it's like there's acres and acres and acres of some of those fields out there now, I believe. And that's kind of what you're talking about with Lake Erie then, too.
Yeah, and there are some pretty intensive programs going on now in southeastern Michigan and northwestern Ohio to help reduce the amount of phosphorus going into Lake Erie.
And so besides that, do they come in and they bale, like, you know, they cut and bale the weeds or, you know, the algae blooms, or how do they do that?
Well, they can't bale an algae bloom, but there are companies out there that harvest weeds from lakes.
Yeah, and Lake Mitchell has hired people to do that before.
Really? And how do they cut it?
They cut it, and then it goes to your shore, and then you got to clean it up. I don't know if they bale it. That's a good point.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
But my understanding, you know, especially living there in the lake, they've had harvesters come in and cut. And so it's just cut, and it's, you know, and then it has the waves go, and it does go to your shore. Well, then we clean up our shore, and we can take it, and Lake Mitchell, you know, there's a little assessment for living on Lake Mitchell. They have somebody once a week comes and picks up all that, and they only want the seaweed. I mean, no, you know, twigs or, you know, just
grass clippings, anything
like
that.
No, they just want, and then my understanding is, and if anybody out there knows if more, please contact us, but they then have somebody that wants to use that has compost.
It makes great compost because there's no weed seeds in it.
Yeah. Even though it's weeds from the lake.
Right. There's no seeds that are going to sprout in your garden in it. And the other type of water we need to think about is the water that's going down into the soil to be our groundwater. If you have a drinking water well, it comes from groundwater. There are some things that we use in agriculture that go into solution in water. Nitrates are one of them. And so is atrazine is a fairly common agricultural chemical. Both of those are highly water soluble. So we have to make sure that we're using what we use to garden and farm in a responsible way so that our groundwater doesn't collect the nitrogen or collect that atrazine. You know, we don't want that. We want to keep our water clean.
Right, because there's people that will have, you know, water tested and it's high nitrates. That's not good.
No, there's actually, especially for infants, there's a something called blue baby syndrome, and what that nitrogen does, it basically ties up the hemoglobin and doesn't allow oxygen to reach the cells like you would in healthy blood. And so that's why we want to be very concerned that our water stays clear of nitrates so that we don't put any babies at risk of this blue baby syndrome.
So on a bigger situation where you have commercial farmers, they get a bunch of rain and they have heavy soil, how do they go about preventing, you know, this runoff then?
The surface runoff? Well, if they've got some kind of plant cover on the soil, such as a cover crop, such as crop residues, because they're using minimal tillage. Sometimes it's no-till, sometimes it's what we call conservation tillage, where there's some tillage, but there's still some crop residue on the field. They can, in like Wisconsin and other places, they do a lot of contour farming, where they set up contours across these long slopes, and just by farming parallel with the slope, that helps intercept the rain that's going down the slope. So, you know, just the direction of your farming can make a difference.
It's interesting if you, you know, drive, we've been on vacation and have seen that. And it's just really interesting how, yeah, the slope and how they farm. Because I know my husband being the farmer, he's like, how in the world do they do that? And I don't think we ever saw any tractors or anybody out there, because he really wanted to know, how are they, you know, planting or harvesting?
Wow. Hey, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Gal. I'm George Corliss. Jelaine Fenner's here with me in the studios on Tracy Lane. And we got Teresa Williams, and she is the Garden Gal. And Teresa, the crop of the month is tomatoes. Now, as we kind of segue into this, I wanted to kind of share a number of years ago, we had talked about tomatoes a little bit, and we talked about determinate and indeterminate. And so let's talk about that just a little bit, because I thought it was so much fun, because before that, I had no clue. Did you, Jelaine, that there
no.
was two different types of tomatoes?
No idea.
And all of a sudden I'm told that, and is one a climber and the other's basically a spreader, or a, how do they go about?
Yeah, what do you call them?
Well, determinate tomato is one that's going to, it's programmed within its own genetic code to stop growing when it reaches a certain height. And a lot of times that's at about the 4 foot. It just isn't going to keep on and grow viney and tall. An indeterminate tomato does grow viney and tall. And as long as it doesn't get killed by something, it will keep growing and growing and growing and growing.
Really? So how high could it grow?
Well, I know that there's a lot of folks with greenhouses who use a string twine that they wrap around the tomato, and every time the tomato approaches the peak of the greenhouse, they let out more twine and allow the base of the tomato vine to just go in a circle on the soil. So I don't know if anybody's ever found out how long that can go on.
Interesting.
It can go on a long time.
And when you're talking about greenhouse tomatoes, how long can they live?
In Michigan, without supplemental heat, I've seen people keep tomatoes in their unheated hoop houses up until November. Past that, it's pretty difficult. And they start tasting a little watery, frankly, if you're going much past. November 15th is about as long as I've seen it. But that certainly, you know, gives you another 6 weeks or more past our first frost, where if you were outdoors and didn't have any protection from it, you'd lose your tomatoes at the first frost.
Or you pick them as they're
green and make fried green tomatoes or something.
And let them sit maybe ripe.
And so determinate and indeterminate, how do you find out what they are? Like if you buy them at a greenhouse or if you buy them at one of the big box stores, how do you find out?
You have to read the tags, because there's no way you can tell just by looking at the tomato. They look the same as a seedling.
And it doesn't matter the like name, you know, yeah, I mean,
or if you do your research, you can find out some that are. A lot of our very early tomatoes tend to be determinate, not always, but if it's an early tomato and you can't tell anything else about it other than it's an early tomato, the tag doesn't tell you if it's determinate or indeterminate. There's a fairly good chance that it's a determinate variety.
And so what about, we're talking about different kinds of tomatoes. What are we talking about? Like Romas, would that be a determinate or an indeterminate?
Could be either. Roma has to do with kind of, with the shape of the tomato and the fact that it's a meatier tomato. It doesn't have as big of a seed cavity, so there's not as much seeds or as much juice. And so Romas tend to make very good canning tomatoes because they have more pulp in them proportionately than our salad tomatoes.
And the romas are not necessarily round. They're sometimes oblong.
They're usually oblong, yeah. In fact, I think all romas are oblong.
And then what kind of colors are we looking at, you know, now with tomatoes and
now there's so many colors. You can get white, yellow, green, orange, red, striped, purple, brown. There's one called Indigo Rose now that's almost black. It's very dark. The only color I haven't seen is blue.
A blue tomato.
I have not seen a blue tomato.
That'd be kind of weird, right?
It would be. I think we don't need to go there.
Yeah. So now, because they're different colors, they're genetically modified?
No. There's a lot of our just naturally occurring tomatoes. Our wild tomatoes are lots of different colors.
Really?
There's even striped tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. Now, are they... those are natural?
A lot of them are, yeah. A lot of our heirlooms are very colorful. Now, there are hybrids that have color to them as well, so it isn't just the heirloom.
I guess I was just thinking out loud, was that a lot of the restaurants maybe would like those to, mm-hmm. you know, kind of color up different salads and other things like that in the summertime.
And one of my favorite salads is a plate of tomatoes of all different kinds and the different colors just arranged on the plate, and it's very lovely and delicious.
Okay, so now they're different colors. Mm-hmm. What about taste?
There are different tastes, but they don't correspond necessarily with the color. I do like a lot of the ones that have a bit of brown to them because they have a more savory taste. The ones that are more pink in general, I would say, have a bit of a sweeter taste. But it's difficult to correlate color and taste exactly because you can have sweet or savory red ones. Mm-hmm. And so there's not an exact correlation
between that. Most people, though, think of tomato, you think red.
Yeah, yeah. No? I do want, there is one correlation with color. The ones that are yellow tend to be lower in acidity. Yeah. So if you're looking for a less acid tomato, one like Taxi, which is yellow, will be less acid.
Now that's what eats you up, right?
Right. Yeah, that's why tomatoes are not, you know, I don't eat tomatoes. But I have had, you know, sweet tomato in something, mm-hmm. and it was much better, or the low acid is, yeah. So the acidic value in most tomatoes is just more than my body can handle.
But, you know, that's also a good food safety point. If you want to can tomatoes and you do hot water bath canning, you should take a look and see, is this a tomato with a high acidity level, or is it one that has been bred to be a low acid tomato to help with, you know, some people that acidity really bothers their stomach. So that's a good thing to keep in mind when you're looking at what to can.
What difference does it make, though, canning then?
A low-acid tomato is not safe to hot water bath can. Okay. It needs to be pressure canned.
Okay.
Now, when most people go and purchase the seedlings to plant in their garden, transplant in their gardens, do they need to know what exactly they're growing the tomato before they even choose what kind of seedling they should use?
I think it's helpful. I mean, you can always just plant a wild card and you get what you get. But if you know you want a can, then yes, you should pay attention to it.
Now, you mentioned the Roma was a lot bulkier, meatier.
That's a good canning tomato.
That's a good canning. Mm-hmm. What about some of the other ones?
There are ones, some of the names from the 50s that were popular home canners are the Rutgers, the Wisconsin 55, and those are round tomatoes. They're not the oblong. The Roma types, that's more the round, not quite big enough to be considered a beefsteak, but the traditional round red.
Now, a lot of times when people are canning like that, they use juicers and other things like that to, you know, eliminate a lot of the work that they used to do. Mm-hmm. Is there any other ways that you can prepare tomatoes, you know, for not overnight, you know, cooking, but, you know, throughout the winter and throughout the spring where you can enjoy the harvest?
This is one of my favorite tips for preserving tomatoes, and that is pick your tomato, wash it, put it in a plastic bag and freeze it. And when you take it out of the freezer and it starts to thaw slightly, skin just slips right off. And that's even good if you want to can tomatoes, but the home gardener might not have a whole bushel full ripe at once. Wash them, stick them in a bag and in the freezer, and when you've got enough to can, you can take them out and the skin slip right off.
So they still taste good?
Yeah, for a canned tomato. I mean, it's not going to taste like a fresh tomato anymore,
okay. But
it makes a great sauce.
So, but you need to put them in a bag, like a Ziploc bag.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what does that do?
It just protects it from freezer burn.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's time for our second break, but you want to stay tuned because we're going to be talking more about tomatoes with the Garden Gal. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.